Welcome to Fireside Chats with Utah Council for Citizen Diplomacy. My name is Julieta Romero, and I am the Fireside Chats Podcast Fellow at UCCD. These Fireside Chats are short conversations with Utah's citizen diplomats who are reformulating the American worldview by bringing their global experience back home to Utah. I welcome Zachary Frankel, the Executive Director of Utah Rivers Council, an organization that does incredible work protecting Utah's rivers and lakes and saving our water sources for the people and wildlife of Utah. So, hi, Zachary, and thank you for joining us today.
Oh, hello. Thank you for having me, Julieta. It's wonderful to be here.
So to start off, I wanted to ask you, for those who have been living in Utah for decades, they can definitely notice a change in temperatures and weather patterns. How do you think this affects our watersheds?
Yeah, you know, there's no question that our temperatures are warming as a function of climate change, our increased carbon emissions over several hundred years. And, you know, when people talk about climate change, they think about heat and they think about summer getting warmer. But the biggest impact we've actually seen in our watersheds is because of the temperature increase in our winters. So because our winters are getting warmer, our precipitation patterns are changing dramatically. In other words, winter is getting shorter. It happens later and it ends earlier in the late portion of the winter, meaning spring comes sooner. So our whole winter is shortening. And that's a big problem because what it means is that what we're getting out of the sky is more often rain and less being snow. And the reason that matters for our runoff patterns, for our rivers and our reservoirs and our lakes, is that about 90% of the water we drink and apply in our farms comes from the melting of our snowpack. And so because winter's getting smaller, our snowpacks are getting smaller. And that's why our rivers and lakes and reservoirs are shrinking. There's less snow, and therefore there's less water in our streams every year.
I would personally believe that, you know, rain and snow would be equally as valuable, but I didn't know that snow is actually more important when it comes to that. So Utah is an extremely geographically diverse state. And so how does constantly being in a state of drought affect our geography?
Yeah, so because we've got less water, well, okay, so Utah is the second most arid state in the United States. So that means we have the least amount of total precipitation, the second least amount of total precipitation in the United States. Nevada is the most arid state and Utah's number two most arid. So what that means is that in combination with climate change and its shrinking of our water, shrinking of our rivers and reservoirs, is that our rivers themselves are under great impact and duress. So if I said to you right now, let's go on a hike and let's walk, you know, 80 miles west of Salt Lake City to Wendover, you know, if we were to do that in summer, spring, summer, or fall, we would want to figure out how to encompass that long journey by stopping at some water sources along the way. Because it's such a dry state, we need our water sources to keep us moving. And the same is true for our wildlife species that cohabitate this state. In other words, our rivers provide habitat for most of our wildlife species. They are connective tissues that support their living ecosystems that support our fish and wildlife legacy. And as climate change and mankind's water diversions are shrinking our rivers, it's having real impacts to these wildlife species. Let me give you just one example that kind of encapsulates how important our rivers are. So 80% of Utah's wildlife species depend upon our rivers and streams for at least a portion of their life cycles. So everything from mammals to amphibians to migratory birds, and of course the fish themselves that live in the water columns of our rivers and creeks and lakes. they need the water in those aquatic landscapes to survive this dry climate. So what we're experiencing are some of the lowest water flows in recorded history. The Great Salt Lake has shrunk 50% as a function of climate change and upstream water diversions. Lake Powell, which is America's second largest reservoir, has shrunk to about 25% of its total capacity. So this is a function of what we're seeing effectively as our energy policy, our carbon emission policy, that is having real impacts on our water supply and the fish and wildlife species that cohabitate our state.
Wow, that's honestly devastating. 50% is a really dramatic amount. And 25%, I remember going to Lake Powell as a young girl. And it makes me really sad seeing the state that it's in right now, because I know it's just only going to get worse. So what does climate change and global warming mean for Utah in terms of a water crisis? And with that, do you believe that the water crisis in Utah, if there is one, is contributing to environmental injustice?
So both very good questions. So there's no question that there are our aquatic landscapes are in a crisis. There's just no question about that. For a long time, the discussion about our water and our water policies and our rivers and lakes has been an us versus them. It's been us humans versus the environment. And there's been this conversation happening in the state house, in city council meetings, you know, about the environment and then what we need, as if we're separate, as if they're two separate entities. What the current era that we're experiencing is teaching us and everybody is that we are one with our environment, and the impacts that these fish and wildlife species are experiencing, the impacts that our aquatic landscapes are experiencing, are impacting us human beings, and not just on some mental or psychological level, but it's actually impacting our health. The best example of this is the Great Salt Lake, which has shrunk dramatically and has exposed lake bed, the bottom parts of the lake. And the reason that that's creating a serious problem on human health is that, so what rivers do is they carry sediment as they move. And so the Great Salt Lake has had all this very fine sediment deposited on the lake bed over the eons that rivers have been carrying those substrates into the lake. Now that the lake has shrunk by 50%, it has exposed that lake bed. And when the wind blows, it becomes fine dust. Specifically, that dust is impacting to human health. And epidemiologists focus on that by calling it particulate matter, or PM10, meaning a reference to the size of that particulate matter. When those particulates are breathed into someone's lungs, some of them get stuck inside our lungs and create all kinds of human health ailments. And so what we're finding is that because especially of our upstream water diversions, our very high municipal water use and our very high agricultural water use, we're diverting too much water upstream of the Great Salt Lake, and it's creating an air quality disaster to the Wasatch Front and its residents. It's having major impacts on people, and yet we still don't yet have completed science documenting which populations are impacted the most. However, you know, lower income populations are obviously more susceptible to these impacts because they have less income to provide healthcare for their families. So we expect a spiraling public health crisis as a function of the state of Utah's very poor policy on protecting the water inflows of the Great Salt Lake that's going to create a major injustice to specific populations that are forced to breathe this air. And that's going to include everybody who is going to have higher exposure rates because they're outdoor laborers to people that don't have very solid health care. So it's going to be a wide-ranging population that is at most risk of experiencing these pulmonary illnesses that are going to accrue from having to breathe this fine dust, some of which includes some fairly dangerous chemicals and substrates in them that are very that are not good for breathing. They're not good for people's health.
It's going to be an interesting journey to see how the Utah population will be affected, because will you say that like most or the general population of the Wasatch Front will be affected?
Yes, we're really unprepared for it right now. We have very poor education efforts by our state air quality agencies to alert the populace to these dust events. There's not much dialogue about it, and there's not much leadership to protect constituents, to keep them from being exposed. Really, the only thing to do when that happens is to go inside and try and avoid breathing the air column outside during these dust events. They typically happen in the spring and fall and high wind periods. When people look outside, they just think, oh, it's overcast, maybe it's going to rain. If they come outside the next morning or the next day, they will see, for example, their car is covered with fine dust that's caked on there. It's really, really, it has a somewhat high humidity content, so it's sticky. And it'll stick to objects, it'll stick to anything, but you can see it as a filament on your car, even when obviously there's no rain, it's not raining. So we are not even really working to even just start educating people about these events to keep them inside. So we are so unprepared for this, not to even mention that we don't have a plan of any substance to return the Great Salt Lake to a higher elevation, a higher water volume to cover that lake bed and keep this health concern from manifesting itself into, you know, epidemiological impacts to different populations.
Yeah, I believe we are definitely underestimating the power of the Great Salt Lake. I mean, it's been around for billions of years, and obviously it holds a lot more power than I think the general population believes. So the Salt Lake Tribune, they released an article recently, and it was titled, "One Crop Uses More Than Half of Utah's Water," and it was referring to alfalfa. But this further disputes the correlation between agriculture and heavy use of water consumption. How do you think we should combat the issue with how much water agriculture consumes while still promoting a strong economy?
Yeah, so, you know, there's a lot of ways that we can lower our total upstream water diversions on the Great Salt Lake, upstream of the Great Salt Lake. And so the biggest users of water in the Great Salt Lake Basin is, as you've pointed out, agriculture and municipal use. And we really need to focus on reducing our water use in both categories. Our agricultural total water use is more than 80% of all the water we consume in Utah. And that's a historical use that's been, you know, happening since, you know, Utah became a state. What we grow mostly is alfalfa hay for cattle and some horses inside Utah, along with many other Western states. And we need to go through an assessment of figuring out how to make our agricultural water use more efficient. It's not that farmers don't want to save water. It's that they don't have the money to install more efficient and less wasteful irrigation infrastructure. There's just many, many farms are still flood irrigating their fields. Even if they're using sprinklers, oftentimes the water that gets to them is in an open dirt canal that is evaporating along the way and water is seeping into the ground. So that's a super inefficient use of water. We can certainly fix the waste in the sector without having to just stop farming. We just need to invest in better delivery systems. And then we need to make sure that the water that we save in those instances goes to the Great Salt Lake. We talk about saving water in our society a lot, and the assumption is that that saved water is kind of like the money we save when we buy something on sale. But just like that same analogy, you know, it doesn't really do us any good if the saved money we get from buying something on sale just goes to buy something else we don't need. We haven't really saved anything. And in that same metaphor, if we're saving water on the farms through better irrigation practices, it doesn't really do anything if that saved water doesn't make it to the Great Salt Lake. And right now, unfortunately, there's no accounting, there's no goal setting, there's no effort to transfer water to the Great Salt Lake. We're getting a lot of lip service about the need to save the Great Salt Lake, but there's no goal setting. There's nothing happening to ensure that the saved water in any sector, be it agriculture or municipal, is going to the Great Salt Lake. And that's what we're really falling down and doing. Yogi Berra has a famous quote that if you don't know where you're going, any direction will get you there. And when it comes to the Great Salt Lake, what we're seeing is a preponderance of discussion of people, and especially politicians, saying we need to save the Great Salt Lake, but there's no goal setting about what that means. And therefore, we're not holding ourselves accountable to restoring the levels of the Great Salt Lake and having them rise again.
So what you're saying here is the key is to invest in a way that would allow water to go back to the Great Salt Lake. That's the key here?
The key, yes. What we want to do with the Great Salt Lake is we want to raise it up 9 or 10 feet in elevation. And if we're not talking about raising the lake 9 or 10 feet, then talking about saving the lake doesn't mean anything. If we put, you know, if you were going to save up money for a down payment for a house, and you know, tell all your friends, I'm going to save so much money. I'm going to really work hard to save money for a down payment. I'm going to the bank right now to put money in the bank for a down payment. Well, if you walk in the bank and you give $10 and you put it in your bank account and you say, there, I accomplished my objective. I've saved money for a down payment. Obviously, if you save $10 a day, it's going to take many, many years, you know, decades before you've saved enough money for a down payment. So if we don't set goals about what it means to save for a house, we'll never get there. And then the same way with the Great Salt Lake, if we don't set a goal of what we're trying to accomplish, then we're never going to get there. And that's not a coincidence. It's that there are a lot of interests that don't want to be held accountable for restoring the Great Salt Lake. And that's why we don't have a goal. We just have general nebulous promises and good feelings about this saving the Great Salt Lake.
I love that analogy with the down payment. I think it really puts things into perspective.
Indeed.
We at Utah Diplomacy have the guiding principle of citizen diplomacy, which is the concept that we all shape foreign relations one handshake at a time. While the work you are doing at Utah Rivers specifically tackles a Utah problem, can you talk through some of the diplomatic efforts you may have had to undertake to tackle this problem here in Utah and with partnering states?
You know, there's a bias inside and outside Utah about the environment and environmentalists. I know of no word that serves to divide people from themselves than the word environmentalist. It's essentially become a word to insult someone as being out of touch, unconcerned about the economy, not interested in the best interests of people. It's become a catch-all criticism to put someone's arguments, you know, into a box and have them not be considered. And so what we've seen is that we come to the table of policymaking and we're talking about impacts to the full spectrum of constituents, both economically, politically and encompassing all ethnicities. And we're coming to the policy table saying, you know, we need to make sure that we have a sustainable water policy. And what a lot of elected officials in Utah and some special interest groups have said, you know, they're just an environmentalist. You can't trust them. And that is really a misnomer that's been hard to deconstruct, because, you know, we're people that care about other people. What drives us is the public interest in treating people ethically and treating people with transparency and good governance. And so we want to work with the entire political spectrum, left and right, Democrat and Republican. And what's been a challenge is to try and deconstruct this label of being an environmentalist to get into the real policy discussion. You know, what are the health impacts of a shrinking Great Salt Lake? What are the economic impacts of wasting money on bad water policies? What are the impacts of having to raise water rates 400% or 500%, especially on the working poor? You know, those are not things one would think of when they think of a traditional environmentalist, but those are the conversations we're having. So as diplomats, what we're trying to do is say, look, we're people just like you, and we're trying to bring the concerns of whatever the impact of the policy is to the foreground so that we can have a robust conversation about it.
Yeah. And although this situation, the water crisis that we're in, is unique to Utah, it's obviously not an issue that will just happen in Utah. It's going to happen here in the U.S. and throughout the globe as well, right?
That's right. And, you know, what's wonderful about America is that we can have a debate and dissent. We can disagree with ourselves and not have to have, you know, our lives in danger. There's a lot of countries where having to advocate for a specific policy literally puts you on a hit list that endangers your life or that of your family. There's certainly political considerations, there's politics and careers, and there's still, especially in Utah, there's not a comfortable level of discussion with two parties disagreeing with each other. You know, democracy works best when there's dissent, when there's debate, when there's disagreement. If it's polite and respectful, then we can learn from our opponents. And in theory, we're going to come up with the best possible policy. Even if we have to compromise with both sides, the idea is let's have a robust debate. Let's educate ourselves about our positions, and then let's come together and make an agreement about how to proceed. Unfortunately, what we see a lot in the water dialogue is voices of dissent are kept from being allowed to speak in public processes. Like a lot of special interest politicking in the United States, we see that powerful lobbyists guide the conversation and exclude voices that disagree. And by not letting people speak, by not letting critics criticize, we are collectively missing out for everybody. And it's typically being done, you know, to benefit the bottom line of some specific special interest. And so that's what we really need to work on for water. You know, there are interests that are profiteering from these water diversions. And that's having an impact on all of us that have to breathe the polluted air of the Wasatch Front during these dust storms. So that's not helping most of the people of Utah. So we have to have a conversation about who's benefiting. And unfortunately, sometimes that's a hard conversation to have. Sometimes even our media is very not willing to acknowledge the profiteering interests of the special interests inside the hallways of the Utah State House.
Yes, definitely. What would you say to individuals who argue that Utah does not have a water dilemma? We obviously still experience snow and rain, so how could there possibly be an issue?
You know, there's a lot of voices that have been denying climate change. They've been denying the fact that our water runoff, our rivers and lakes are shrinking because of climate change. I was having a conversation last summer with a legislator in the Utah State House, and I took him aside in the hallway and I said, look, you know, I really want you to understand that the data clearly indicates that climate change is shrinking our flows. And he said to me, you know, look, like I said in there in committee, we just need one big winner. And I said, no, that's not the case. That's not what the data says. You know, we would need a series of gigantic winners, and we would have to stop using water entirely for some of these lakes and reservoirs to recover. And the way to think about it is this. If you made an investment in a company through an investment officer, through a, you know, financial broker, and you came back a year later and said, hey, you know, how's that company doing? How's it going? And the financial advisor said, oh, you know, that company went bankrupt. You wouldn't say, oh, well, let's just put $1 million back into it and don't be so negative. Unfortunately, that's kind of the attitude when we go talk about climate change and we say this is the new era. This is a 1,000-year-long mega drought. We haven't seen a period this dry in 1,000 years of record in the geologic timeline. They say, oh, Zach, you're just being negative. And that's where I get that analogy. It's like, come on, if your company goes bankrupt, you don't pour more money into it. And if we have a bankrupt climate policy, you know, we need to wake up and realize we're in a new era, and we can't just rely upon some general sense that things are going to be okay. We owe it to the constituents we serve to be steely-eyed and wide open about what's really happening in this world.
Yeah, and it's not a matter of trying to be positive or negative. It's just the facts. You can't deny the facts that are clearly there.
Data and facts is what should be driving our policymaking. That's what most people want. They want their value systems to be represented as well. But clearly, if you're in the backseat of an automobile and you're not driving and you feel like the driver is going too fast because the wheels are squealing around a blind corner over a cliff, you're going to tell the driver to slow down based on the data. And we need to do that too. We need to change the trajectory of our policies so that we can, you know, just take into the data that we all know is there and is real. And that's just common sense. That's what we need to do for our public interest.
Yeah, I love the analogies you give. I feel like it really helps put things into perspective. My last question for you is, what advice would you give to individuals who are interested in making changes in their water consumption, as well as educating themselves on this issue?
So really easy. The thing to do is to pick the low-hanging fruit first. So most of the water we use in our cities is outdoors on our landscapes, meaning it's on our grass. And so some 65 to 75% of the water we use every year in our cities is happening outdoors in the summer months on our houses, in our houses, in our businesses, and in our institutions. We're using copious amounts of water outside. So the first thing individuals can do is inventory how they're using water outside their house. Doesn't matter whether they're renting or whether they own a house, you know, just finding a way to reduce the water they use outside greatly, greatly impacts their total water footprint. So the first step is to make sure there's no watering of sidewalks, of roadways, or of gutters. That's not a use of water. That's just a waste of water. And then the second thing is to say, well, do I really need this grass to be here? Can I remove this grass and replace it with something that doesn't need water? If the answer, if the only purpose of grass, if the only use of grass is to be mowed, then that's non-functional turf. It's not serving any purpose. If people want a grass lawn because they want to picnic or they want to play on it, you know, there's some kind of activity they use their grass and they actually walk on it and use it, that's fine. But if it's just an ornament for, and it's basically just eye candy, it's non-functional, And what they need to recognize is that that is a water footprint that is coming out of the watershed they live in. If they live on the Wasatch Front, that's coming out of water that would otherwise go to the Great Salt Lake. And we need to get rid of that non-functional turf because it has no purpose whatsoever. So outdoor water use is really the key. And then, of course, for individuals that really want to keep their outdoor watered landscapes, the trick is to not turn on their sprinklers too early in the year and to turn them off. So people have this idea that when grass turns yellow, it's quote unquote dead. It's actually not dead. In fact, it's very, very hard to kill your grass. Just because it turns yellow, all that means is it's gone dormant. And so that's just a temporary state for that plant. So people can let their grass go yellow and it won't kill it. It'll come back the following year very easily. If we sent all of our grass into dormancy in August, we would save vast quantities of water, which could go to the Great Salt Lake. Inside the home, you know, then the rest of it is trying to make sure you're using low flow plumbing fixtures, low flow toilets, low flow shower heads, low flow faucets. All of those things are available at your local big box store. Just look for the Water Sense label. The rest of it is just don't leave the water on all the time. If you're brushing your teeth, turn your water off when you're not using the water. If you're washing the dishes, turn the water off. You don't need the water flowing all the time and just becoming more aware of how we all use water and our connection to water is really the key to good stewardship of our living aquatic landscapes.
I love that. That's very useful. And I also heard that like maybe instead of having grass, maybe switching to like native plants and species that live in the state is also a good idea. And I know Utah is the home to many beautiful native plants. So what do you think about that?
That's absolutely true. What that's called is xeriscaping. And it doesn't mean zero scaping. It means xeriscaping. And so our native plants use much less water because they, of course, evolved in this dry, second driest state climate in the U.S. And so what's wonderful about xeric landscapes, these native plants, is that they're actually very diverse. So we ripped out our grass when we bought our home a couple decades ago, and we planted a xeric landscape, and we have a number of complicated plants in our front yard. And what we've found is that it's become a wonderful habitat for local wildlife. So we'll have small flocks of quail that hide in these bushes and enjoy the refuge offered that they wouldn't have if it was all grass. We find raptors that come to prey, you know, hawks that come to prey on some of these species. We find robins and blackbirds are really habitating our yard as opposed to our neighbors that just have a monocrop of grass. So it's not just that we get a water savings by shifting to a xeric landscape that uses much less water. It's also that we are embracing backyard biodiversity, and it's just a joy to watch. It's really fun to watch the quail in your front yard and know that you're also saving water in the process.
I love that. I love the idea of embracing Utah's biodiversity. I think it's very beautiful and really underappreciated.
Indeed, indeed.
So, Zachary, as our conversation comes to an end, are there any last words you would like to say?
You know, the only thing I would say is that I know I have conveyed some difficult subjects, some things that are prone to getting people down. But the trick is to continue to endeavor. A friend of mine, Brock Evans, one of the conservation pioneers in the United States, has always said, endless pressure, endlessly applied. That's really what we need. We don't have another alternative. We have to fight for what we need to implement in this world. We can't just throw our hands up and say it's hopeless. We can't bury our heads under our pillows. We have no choice but to solve the problem. So I would urge people to just roll up their sleeves and join me and my colleagues and all of our supporters, and let's get busy solving these problems. The solutions are out there. They're achievable when we can implement changes that benefit everybody.
That's it for today. Thank you guys for listening. To learn more about today's guests and our fireside chats, check out our website, utahdiplomacy.org, as well as explore our website to learn more about how to get involved with diplomacy in Utah, one handshake at a time.